Hello and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me in a bit will be Candace LaPage, and we will review this week's movie. And, well, what can I say? It's 1 week, I think it's 1 week until reading week, or reading week starts at the end of this week. Not that you should be going anywhere if you are a student at the U of G and are thinking about going somewhere on reading week, even if that's just home. That, of course, is not recommended. We are still in semi-lockdown measures here. Although, it's worth noting, this has almost been doing this for a year now. A little over a month, it will be a year that we have been locked down, and well, what else can we say about that? We will, however, roll on with End Credits. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new relationship drama, Malcolm and Marie, which you can now stream on the Netflix. Before that, we're going to do some good old-fashioned movie news to start the show. And, one of the saddest stories, I think, coming out of the last week of movie news was the death of Canadian actor Christopher Plummer, who passed away at the age of 91. Was working till the, well, I was going to say bitter end, and I suppose it is bitter if you have enjoyed Christopher Plummer's acting over the last seven decades. But he was still working. He was just finished, I think, the second season of a TV show called Departure, which was on Global, is kind of like a Canadian BBC, I think, co-production, which is about people investigating a missing plane. If I don't know the show terribly well. I know that Archie Punjabi was the star, and I only kind of recognize it from some commercials I saw. But, you know, it starred Christopher Plummer, Academy Award winner Christopher Plummer, Emmy winner Christopher Plummer, Tony Award winner Christopher Plummer. I think he won all the acting awards at one time or another. Interestingly, he did not win an Oscar till he was 81 years old. You think Christopher Plummer, this incredible career with so many possible things to be award-winning for, did not finally win his Oscar until, I think, 2011 is when Beginners came out, and that's when he won. Christopher Plummer, of course, is very famous for his time at the Stratford Festival. He was in the first class at the Stratford Festival and went back many, many times. While he was at Stratford, he was the mentor for another young actor named... another young actor from the Montreal area, I should say, named William Shatner. And, of course, what a funny world we would live in if it was perhaps William Shatner that starred in The Sound of Music and Christopher Plummer, who was Captain Kirk. I'm not sure what pivots and spigots we'd have to change in the time-space continuum to make that possible. But, it could have been a very real possibility. Of course, Christopher Plummer called The Sound of Music The Sound of Mucus. He was not a fan. I mean, he appreciated that a lot of people loved that movie. He did not appreciate the artistic value of The Sound of Music, although he appreciated Julie Andrews and was good friends with her. So, I mean, Knives Out is another one that sticks out to me, I guess because that's recent, and, you know, he had a small role in Knives Out. Great. He was great in Knives Out for the little bit he was in it at the beginning. And of course, I mean, as a Trekkie, I always remember him as the bad guy in Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, playing General Chang, who's this Klingon that spouts Shakespeare and wears an eye patch. It's a very Christopher Plummer role. And of course, it had him and William Shatner facing off against each other on screen, which I think that's the only place that happened is in Star Trek VI, where the two of them were acting against one another. And it's just this great scene at the beginning when Chang and Kirk come face to face. And he says, "I've so wanted to meet you, Captain. You could tell Christopher Plummer loved every minute of being the Klingon heavy in a Star Trek movie." And I guess I have my own. I'm not someone who gets particularly upset about the death of celebrities, but I'm, you know, Christopher Plummer definitely made me feel a bit sad losing him. We go from that to, well, I'm going to do a couple of quick notes. Number one on my quick notes here is, we've talked a lot on the show about the Snyder cut of Justice League. That, of course, is, something that's been under process for the last year. It comes out on March 18th on HBO Max in the United States, but the good news is it also comes out on March 18th on Crave. Crave has been picking up a lot of HBO Max stuff, but it doesn't pick up everything. I mean, they're most notably the Warner Brothers movies that were supposed to come out in theaters or coming out in theaters in some places, also being released by HBO Max. Things like Wonder Woman 1984 and Little Things, which came out a couple of weeks ago. They are available on premium VOD, but they are not available through Crave, which, as I said, is carrying much of the HBO Max catalog. However, they will be carrying the Snyder Cut, so if you are anxiously awaiting seeing what Zack Snyder's rendition of Justice League looks like, I could take it or leave it, but I am still curious. But you will be able to watch that Crave if you subscribe to Crave, and that will be free of charge. The other thing that I find curious is this affair with Armie Hammer, and you may have seen Armie Hammer in your social media mentions. And particularly about this whole thing of cannibalism, that Armie Hammer is a cannibal, or that he wants to be a cannibal. It started with like these social media posts that were supposedly screen grabs of DMs and messages he was sending to ex-girlfriends about wanting to, well, essentially eat them, literally eat them. And that started this whole thing about Armie Hammer and cannibalism trending. What that actually ended up revealing was a number of women coming out and accusing Armie Hammer of being abusive and harassing them. And, I mean, it's another kind of sad Me Too story of a prominent actor getting away with, seemingly, allegedly getting away with all kinds of bad behavior. And a number of women have put their names to the story, saying that the cannibalism quotes and the DMs therein had a particular, well, I hate to say the word flavor, at least it was a familiar tone is what they were getting at. Anyway. What I really want to focus on in our last maybe 10 minutes or so is the Golden Globes. The nominations for the Golden Globes were announced last week, and we are kind of behind our times. Normally we'd be getting ready for Oscars, but the Golden Globes were delayed, obviously, because of COVID, which delays the Oscars, and so on and so forth. So in a time when we would typically be getting the Oscar nominations and talking about who might be winning Oscars in a couple of weeks, we get the Golden Globe nominations. I hate to say this, the pickings are slim, but it kind of feels that way. The Mank got the most nominations with 6, followed by The Trial for the Chicago 7, The Trial of the Chicago 7 with 5, followed by 4 each for The Father, No Man Land, and Promising Young Woman. And then Borat comes in next with 3 nominations there, including Best Picture Comedy, Best Actor Comedy, and Best Actress Comedy for the leads, and I think that's richly deserved. So this is, I mean, obvious reasons. This is the year for streamers to get nominations. So Netflix has the most nominations with 42. Now, because the Golden Globes gives out awards for TV too, that is 22 for film and 20 for TV. Next, coming in second place was Amazon Prime with 10 nominations, 7 for film and 3 for TV. And then after that, you get tied for 5 nominations each is Focus Features, Searchlight Pictures, Sony Picture Classics, and Walt Disney. And those first three in particular, I mean, those are usually the distributors that get all the nominations because they're releasing the highly influential indies that typically get these kinds of awards. But I mean, this year there was, after March, there was really no theatrical release, or there wasn't much in the way of theatrical releases. Of, you know, Tenet comes to mind, and movies like Let Him In and Wonder Woman 1984 did open in some theaters, but there weren't a lot of theaters open at the time when Wonder Woman came out, even here in the Greater Toronto Area. So if there was ever a year for streamers to plant the flag, it was definitely this one. Let me just talk about some of the snubs first. The Five Bloods, which made a lot of top five lists here on end credits, completely snubbed. Not even an award nomination for Delroy Lindo, who a lot of people were absolutely sure was going to get a nomination. He did not get a nomination for Best Actor or Best Supporting Actor, and that is a damn shame. Regina King was nominated for Best Director for One Night in Miami, and we did that movie review a couple of weeks ago, and it was well received by myself and Peter. She got a Best Director nomination, but she was the only person of color to get a Best Director nomination. Actually, I don't think that's necessarily... No, there, she's not the only person of color, but she's the only black person to get a nomination. And indeed, when you look at the 10 Best Film categories, the only one to get a Best Picture nomination was No Man Land, which is directed by Chloe Zhao, who is a Chinese filmmaker. So there's still some diversity issues here at the Golden Globes, which is kind of surprising because it's the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. But one of the things about the Golden Globes, of course, is that they are, by and large, all about the star power and getting the stars in. And of course, that's not going to be impossible because there isn't going to be the big... I think it's the Beverly Hilton they hold the Golden Globes. There's not going to be any big party there. It is going to be a bicoastal affair, a remote affair, with Amy Poehler hosting from L.A. and Tina Fey hosting from New York. And a lot of people will be presenting and receiving awards from their home. So that'll be interesting to see what the show looks like. To use some of our last few minutes here to talk about the nominations. So the for Best Director, the nominees are Emerald Fennell for Promising Young Woman, David Fincher for Mank, Regina King for One Night in Miami, Aaron Sorkin for Trial of the Chicago 7, and Chloe Zhao from Nomadland. I think this is probably a strong indicator that David Fincher is going to get his Oscar, recognizing again this is the Golden Globes, but I think the Oscar is going to be David Fincher's this year, and it's a shame because I don't think Mank is his best work. It's technically very, very good, but it's not ideally the award I would give him the Best Picture or the Best Director Oscar for. Best Actress in a Musical Comedy, Maria Bakalova for Borat, Kate Hudson for Music, Michelle Pfeiffer for French Exit, Rosamund Pike for I Care a Lot, Anna Taylor-Joy for Emma. I have not seen a lot of those nominees. For Best Actor in a Motion Picture Drama, there's Riz Ahmed with The Sound of Metal, which we will be reviewing in a couple of weeks. Chadwick Boseman for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which we have reviewed. Anthony Hopkins for The Father, Gary Oldman for Mank, Tahar Rahim for The Mauritanian, which is a movie I'm not terribly familiar with, I'm sorry to say. Best Actor in a Motion Picture, Musical or Comedy, Sacha Baron Cohen for Borat, James Corden for The Prom, and there was a lot of blowback on this one on social media because somebody joked James Corden playing gay for 2 hours gets him a Golden Globe nomination, everyone else playing gay all their lives gets the Misery, but I digress. Lin-Manuel Miranda for Hamilton, Dev Patel for The Personal History of David Copperfield, and Andy Samberg for Palm Springs. Best Actress in a Motion Picture Drama, Viola Davis for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, Audra Day for the United States versus Billie Holiday. I'm not sure that's come out yet in Canada. Vanessa Kirby for Pieces of a Woman. Frances McDormand for Nomadland, which will come out in Canada, I think, next week. It'll be available on premium VOD, so look out for that. And then Carey Mulligan for Promising Young Woman. Best Motion Picture Drama, The Father, Mank, No Man Land, Promising Young Woman, and Trial of the Chicago 7. I think, obviously, Mank is the standout there. And then maybe to wrap up, Best Actor in a Supporting Role in a Motion Picture, Sacha Baron Cohen for The Chicago 7, Daniel Kaluuya for Judas and the Black Messiah, which doesn't come out for another couple of weeks. That's going to be on premium VOD because it's a Warner Brothers production, so it'll be coming out on HBO Max in the States. Jared Leto for The Little Things. Eek. Bill Murray for On the Rocks, which you can watch on Apple TV Plus, and then Leslie Odom Jr. for One Night in Miami. Sadly, no nomination for Kingsley Benadire as Malcolm X in that movie, because I think he was kind of the standout. Best Motion Picture, Musical Comedy, Borat, Hamilton, Palm Springs, Music, and The Prom. Best Actress in a Supporting Role, Glenn Close for Hillbilly Elegy, Olivia Colman for The Father, Jodie Foster for The Mauritanian, Amanda Seyfried for Mank, and Helen Zengel for News of the World. So Glenn Close gets a nod for Hillbilly Elegy. Amy Adams is shut out, and there were some interesting reactions online about people feeling reticent about Amy Adams getting nominated for Hillbilly Elegy. And I'll let you find those for your own, because I have to throw this to our musical break. In keeping with Black History Month, we are going to play a bit off the playlist for Black Bandcamp. This is Hip Hop Unplugged by Crystals Bacon on his film, his album, Hip Hop Unplugged. This is the song It's the Beatbox. We'll be back in a minute with a review of Malcolm and Marie. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. It's so versatile that we can make it do both. It's the beatbox. It's the beatbox. The human beatbox. Yeah, it's the beatbox. Come on, I get with me. It's the beatbox. Yeah, it's the beatbox. Come on, yeah, it's the beatbox. It's the beatbox. Now, we all have a million drums that's inside our chest, but be careful when you use them, you could run out of breath. Now, I could easily cough and throw the beatbox off, I mix the beat with the cough, and the problem is solved.
Yeah, let's just talk tomorrow.
But you're upset with me.
It's not that big of a deal.
I can't go to bed knowing that you're angry.
Malcolm, I promise you, nothing productive is going to be said tonight.
How do you know?
Because I know you.
What does that mean?
And I love you.
What does that mean?
It means that you are literally incapable of de-escalating a situation unless it's work-related. And even then, it's 50-50.
Why is it that anytime anything good happens in our lives, you have to find something? Anything, the most minor detail to harp on, to make ugly, to ensure that there's no reason to celebrate.
Really? You want to go there?
Yes.
Okay.
All right, then what is it?
Your speech, Malcolm.
Oh, give me a break. You're outside of your mind. When I said you find the most minor detail and make it ugly, I meant it.
You forgot to thank me, Malcolm. It's not a minor detail, that's a big one.
But I've thanked you a million times before. You know that I'm thankful. You know that I'm appreciative. And you know I made a mistake, so why turn it into something more?
Because it is more.
And that was a clip from Malcolm and Marie. It is the new film from Sam Levinson, and it stars Zendaya and John David Washington. Okay, joining me on the line is Candace Bosch. Candace,
that's me.
Yes, it is you. Or someone that sounds remarkably like you and is using your Skype account.
Oh, well, yeah. We don't talk about that person.
Now people should be on the lookout for somebody who like sounds like they smoke 4 packs a day on a future.
Yeah, this is Candace LePage.
Honestly, I sounded like that on a call yesterday. I had a number of meetings and mm-hmm. I spoke a lot, and it's very dry in my apartment. And mm-hmm. By the last meeting, I was just, it was pretty bad. I basically had to eventually just say, you know what, I'm just going to type out the rest of what I have to say.
Yeah, dry. That's the winter curse. I've had dry hands lately, and I hate that. It's a terrible feeling.
Yep.
Dry hands, dry mouth. Dry. Yeah.
I hear you.
All right.
That's the weather report.
That's the weather. That's the way it is on this February afternoon. So we're here to talk about Malcolm and Marie, which is currently on Netflix, as I said. And Candace, you volunteered this as the movie you wanted to review this week. So what was the appeal of Malcolm and Marie for you?
Yeah, so I have been trying to be better at choosing films that don't live in my genre that I just go to automatically. Last year was, you know, a little heavy on the horror and teen melodrama. So I'm, and the reality is that I like a lot of other movies. It's just, I'm not sure if you know, but we're going through a pandemic right now, and we're at about month 12 of it, 11, depending on how close you're watching the news. Mm-hmm. And, you know, comfort is easy. It's the thing that we all crave. So I was spending a lot of time last year just being comfortable. So this year I'm trying to go outside of my my fallback comfort level, which sounds ridiculous because, like I said, I do like other movies. I do like, you know, just dramas, and especially a drama that this looked like. So I saw it on Netflix when I was going through the new releases are coming soon. And thank you, Netflix, for creating that new sort of section of new releases. And, you know, it's really helping me out so I can see what's coming. Mm-hmm. But so as I was scrolling through there, I'll say I basically just saw the cover art on Netflix. Black and white, John David Washington and Zendaya, both, you know, really interesting actors who are also very attractive. So it's just a nice looking, you know, nice looking poster. I read the little blurb about, you know, coming home from a movie premiere. She's given so much to his career and, you know, night of consequences, passion, whatever. And I was like, okay, well, this sounds interesting. Also the black and white feature, mm-hmm. really, you know, I was like, this, I like people who make artistic choices. I mean, there's no reason ever to do black and white nowadays. So it's always a choice. So I was like, you know what, there's something here. Let's watch it. And it's not a horror movie. Which is great. Interestingly, I didn't, you know, as I said, I just sort of chose it like that. So I didn't look too much further into it. So I was, and I really try hard not to read anything other people are saying about films before I watch it so that I can go in, you know, and come out with my own opinion and then start to look around.
Mm-hmm.
So I was surprised to find out that it wasn't a black director or writer of this film. Mm-hmm. I'll be honest, I just sort of assumed, and it's not. And you know, that could be something we talk about, you know, in this conversation. But I was surprised to find that out. And there has been some online chatter about the mm-hmm. film, I'll say, since then, because for a lot of reasons. But I think, you know, part of it is the fact that the director, Sam Levinson, is kind of writing about something that he maybe doesn't know much mm-hmm. about.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, on the other side, I'll say also, like, it's literally a film about two people, you know, working in the movie industry. So he does know about that, mm-hmm. you know, on the precipice of becoming kind of a big star. And I'll say probably Sam Levinson knows about that as well, because I'll admit I've never actually seen any of his films because he is still a pretty sort of a new up and coming director. So, mm-hmm. you know. That part is probably, you know, he kind of understands that part and the waiting for the reviews and the talking about the premiere and all that. And then it's also just a film about a couple and their, you know, their problems,
mm-hmm.
you know, problems that any couple have. But then also in this story, sort of problems that are a little bit unique to artists. You know, two artists in one relationship together and how they work about that. So, you know, in that way, he probably is writing a lot about things that he knows. So.
Mm-hmm. A lot to unpack there, but the.
Sorry.
No, it's fine.
Right into it.
No, it's fine. The whole thing with Sam Levinson, of course, is the son of Barry Levinson, the Academy Award winning director of Rain Man and other movies.
Diner, like one of Diner, my favorite yes. movies of all time.
Well, I just sort of Rain Man came to mind because that's what he won the Oscar for. So, I mean, there is the things you're talking about in terms of like him addressing or him addressing sort of racial inequities in Hollywood. It's kind of doubly comes off as a little tin-eared, considering he has an easier time of it because his father is a famous filmmaker in his own right. So it's Sam Levinson undoubtedly has had an easier time of it in Hollywood versus someone like John David Washington, who was not the son of Hollywood. Well, John David Washington is the son of Hollywood royalty in real life.
Yes.
But the character he's supposed to be playing is not from a Hollywood family. Yeah.
Sorry, and not to stop you, but just on that specifically, you know, they do address the fact in the film that John David Washington's character of Malcolm talks about being Black and how it, you know, informs him or doesn't inform his mm-hmm. artwork. And Zendaya's character, Marie, you know, tells him that he's basically, you know, full of excrement because yeah. he is not, you know, he's come from a life of privilege, even as a Black person. So, you know, you could say again that Sam Levinson, because there is obviously there's a I'm making a broad statement here based on his last name, but I'm assuming that they're a Jewish family. And so in Hollywood, you know, there is certainly both racism and elitism
mm-hmm.
it around being Jewish in Hollywood. So,
mm-hmm. No, and I think that's all perfectly fair too, and I think Sam Levinson is, I don't know if he's trying to work through some things or not, or whether it's a matter of like write what you know. I almost wish that he didn't make the couple like Hollywood that seems to automatically, I don't know. There's something about that's kind of rubs you the wrong way because you're into a world where everybody's kind of up each other's butts anyway. The whole tirade that Malcolm goes on about critics and this poor woman from the LA Times, he's constantly berating in absentia. It just strikes me as hollow as whenever filmmakers get into critiquing critics, whether that's like the Bob Balaban character in Lady in the Water or something that's just like crass and obscene as Mayor Ebert and Godzilla. It just strikes me as petty and pointless to when filmmakers start screaming at critics in their work. I'm not sure to whom that was directed at, but I will also say that the movie doesn't take that terribly serious as well, because there's this whole scene where Malcolm goes on a tirade about this initial review, which is overwhelmingly positive, but he doesn't like the tone of it. And I did enjoy what I enjoyed in that scene was watching Marie's reaction, and Zendaya plays bemused very, very well in that scene, watching Malcolm unload on this poor woman from the LA Times. But
Well, and interestingly about that, you know, when you talk about how you don't like the pettiness of when a director, you know, puts in these things about like how unintelligent the critics are. And I would agree with you, but at the same time, you know, as I was watching both that like tirade, but even earlier on, right as we're introduced to Malcolm, we're introduced to Malcolm and we are told who he is right away, as far as I'm concerned. And that is a self-centered, self-absorbed, like narcissistic know-it-all who believes that he knows better than everybody else. Mm-hmm. And so when he's going on that tirade later, which was really like impressive, like a monologue. I don't even know how long it went on. Maybe you timed it. I don't know. It was it was upwards of 8 or 9 minutes of just John David Washington saying a lot of things and yelling and et cetera. But as we're going, you know, he's going through that. Is Sam Levinson writing that? And it might be both. It might be him getting a little bit of, you know, his own personal like feelings on the page. But I don't believe we're supposed to be watching that and going, yeah, Malcolm is right. We're supposed to be watching it going, okay, you have some of your own problems that you need to deal with, and maybe this tirade is helping you deal with them, but I feel like they're actually just amplifying all of your feelings on this issue. So while I agree with you that it's kind of annoying and petty when a director does that, I also am not sure if that's really what Levinson is doing here, because to me it was clear that as the audience, we're supposed to see Malcolm as ridiculous in this moment.
Oh, no, I definitely think we're meant to see Malcolm as ridiculous. I'm not sure. I mean, I struggle with the feeling that there is a lot of padding in this movie. I think people underestimate just how much punch you can cram into, like, 90 minutes. Like, I think a lot about Lights Out, which is, you know, without the credits, basically like a 75-minute movie. And it gets in, it gets out. There's some scares. There's some lessons learned. You know, mom ends it all. And then we're out. And it's short. It's punchy. It doesn't overstay its welcome. And I think to get at what you were saying is, like, we get everything we need to know about Malcolm in those like opening shots when Marie clearly has something on her mind, and he is ebullient in his in the success of this premiere. And there's a lot of stuff said in that initial scene too, where we kind of get his opinion about the critics and the writers and the trying to outwit the white guy from Variety by talking about William Wyler and making that guy wonder for a minute if William Wyler was black. And I think we get everything we need to know about Malcolm from that initial scene, as you said. the issue then is that we get this scene later on where it just feels like it is all about screaming at the critic. And it's one of these scenes, like you said, I did not time it, so I do not know how long it went on. I kind of wish in retrospect that I had. But the scene is... The scene basically collapses on itself to put it a certain way, because it just feels like the tires are spinning in the mud once we get to a certain point where, you know, he's out on the balcony, not the balcony, but the patio. And that's another thing too. I was wondering if these people had neighbors at all, but it just, there are certain scenes that make this feel padded. And that is definitely one of them, because it feels like Sam Loomis had some stuff to say about critics to get off his chest.
Yeah. Yeah. Just sort of regarding some of the feedback I've seen on the internet about this film. So I follow Black Twitter quite a bit. I have, you know, over the last 4 years or so, really been increasing my follows of people who are Black and are talking about pop culture or politics or whatever on the internet.
Not just Armand White.
So Black Twitter has had some feelings, particularly Black feminist Twitter, about the character of Malcolm, and also I would say about John David Washington, who I think. And again, and I don't know, I you know, I haven't looked too far into it. I also am not entirely sure where Sam Levinson sits on this, but it sort of reminds me of a lot of the stuff about the Joker, or excuse me, just like Joker, the film, where you can watch it and feel like they're making a statement against, misogyny and male toxicity and the mental health field and that sort of stuff. But then when you hear Joaquin Phoenix and the director, whose name I can't think of right now, when they're talking about their film, yeah, that's not what they're saying the film is about. And so you think, oh, okay, so I thought you were doing something, saying something, and I was with you, but now it seems like you don't actually think that that's what you're trying to say. And so I don't know here, in this film, what Sam Levinson is trying to say about the character of Malcolm, whether he's right or whether he's wrong, whether we're supposed to empathize with him. But I do, you know, I definitely saw at least one sort of interview where John David Washington described his character as romantic, which is incorrect as far as I'm concerned, and is in some ways part of the problem with people who have some of the behaviors that Malcolm's character have, where they don't really see their flaws. And so I'm not sure if Sam Levinson also believes that Malcolm is romantic, or if he is actually talking about, you know, the flaws of this person. And it's not even that Malcolm is a man, because the flaws are about being overly absorbed with yourself and what other people think of you and how you're presenting to the world. And I think sometimes people who have that can seem romantic because they've chosen to look romantic as part of their the way they want the world to see them. And I believe Malcolm has, you know, they talk about that, you know, he's sensitive and, you know, he listens to soul music that's about love and, you know, all these things. He's stood beside this woman that he's been with, you know, through some mental health challenges around addictions, but it's all part of the character he shows other people. It's not actually who he is.
Right. There's a really great line where Marie says something to the effect of, you are never going to be a better man than what you are right now, which is, you know, I guess someone with enough ego would hear that and go like, yes, I am awesome. But the point of the line is that, no, you are not awesome because you cannot recognize your own flaws and you cannot address those flaws. And this is a whole conversation, which is basically tantamount to he forgets to thank her at this film premiere when essentially there's kind of no movie about her because it's partially inspired by her. But it's not necessarily that acknowledgement that it's, you know, kind of based on her life or partially based on her life that she wants. It's all the things that go along with that, like being a creative collaborator, like being the woman who makes a mac and cheese when they get home. Mm-hmm. And all the things in between, the good and the bad and the ugly. And I think I didn't see that interview with Washington, but I think what he might be trying to get at is that I think Malcolm thinks he's a romantic hero when he's really not. And he's also partially a victim of this, you know, kind of long-standing ideal, perpetuated in part by Hollywood, this idea of the mad genius who is not a great people person and is kind of a trash person, but since they're such a genius, people kind of let it slide. And it's a kind of heinous trope, and as especially more heinous since, you know, in the years following Me Too, where we've seen a lot of truly genius people, you know, be revealed as monsters.
Garbage.
I was gonna say monsters in their personal life, but I mean Garbage works just as well. And I there is kind of a disbalance here because I feel that Marie is a very complex character and Zendaya plays that very, very well. And I'm not saying John David Washington is bad, but there are not as many dimensions to Malcolm as there are to Marie. And I am curious about if that's because Sam Levinson, who writes and directs Euphoria, which stars Zendaya, whether there's that kind of pre-existing working relationship, that, you know, it's kind of a, also because I think much of the crew is also from Euphoria, so it's basically the Euphoria pandemic project. But you know, so I do wonder if he has a bit more sympathy towards Marie and not so much towards Malcolm. So there's the edges on Marie are sort of more sharper than the rounded edges on Malcolm, which I guess maybe he thought Washington might be able to, I don't know, make a bit sharper, but I don't know. It just felt like this is definitely more Marie's movie than Malcolm's. And I mean, maybe that was the recipe in the original screenplay, but I think it also could be a function of just the close working relationship between director and star too.
Mm-hmm. And I will say that this is really the first time I've ever watched Zendaya act and recognize that it's Zendaya, who apparently is like a thing. Like, I don't know how long she's been around. Did she used to be a Disney star or something? But I don't know. It's just like suddenly it felt like everybody was talking about Zendaya. And I was like, who the heck is this person? I've never seen anything. Which I think is not true because she's in Spider-Man, right?
Well, I think most people probably recognize her from Spider-Man. And I'm just looking up her filmography. And yes, she was on a show called Shake It Up, which is a Disney Channel show that ran for 4 years.
Okay.
So yeah, she was on this show, and then she was on, because they all cross over with each other. So she was on a couple of other Disney shows too as the same character. And so I mean that was 2010. That she started that, so she's been at it for a while.
Yeah. So, you know, I obviously
and she's 24 years old.
Yes. Yeah. And and she looked it when she took her makeup off in the movie when Marie removed all of her, you know, red carpet drag, we'll call it. But yeah, so this is certainly the first time that I have watched Zendaya act and be aware that she is a presence that people talk about a lot. So I was a little more in tune with watching like what she was doing and how she was acting, because I was like, oh, this is the woman that everybody talks about that seems like the second coming of Lindsay Lohan or something. I don't know.
Oh, you cursed except, her.
No, I know. I was trying to think of another like person who was a Disney star and a big name that every maybe Raven Simone. She's the second coming of Raven Simone.
Or Hillary Duff, or
sure, Hillary. Yeah, but anyways, so I was definitely watching her, you know, performance, and it was really pretty incredible, because you're right, like she had a lot to do and a lot of emotions to carry and to show, and you know, equally Marie as her character. The character of Marie holds a lot of does a lot of emotional labor in that relationship.
Yeah,
like she holds a lot together, and it was really incredible. And in some ways, like, the pacing of the film was a little bit weird. And it probably went on a little bit too long. And I'm not sure, you know, it's hard to say, because it's essentially, it's almost sort of like a real time from the time they get home from the red carpet until they end their fight, essentially. but within the fight, and anybody who's probably been in a relationship sort of understands, sometimes, you know, you get to places within a fight where you feel like the fight's over and then something brings it back. And it was always really interesting to see her when you could just see, you're like, oh yeah, no, there's still something more there. And it felt like so much gaslighting all the time. Whenever she would bring something back, and Malcolm would just be like, oh, we're back to this. And oh, this is what it's been about the whole time. And all these things. And it's just like, can you just, you know, it takes time to process feelings. I know you don't process feelings, so you don't actually know how long it takes to process through them and remove the layers and find out what, you know, she was angry because he didn't thank her. Except she wasn't even angry because he didn't thank her at first. You know, she forgave him immediately at the actual event. And when she came home, she was like, it turns out I am a little bit mad about that because of all these things. And then the fight moved into other things. And then it came back to, no, actually, I'm still like, it's this thing that I'm mad about. And it's not because you didn't thank me, but because of all the other things that it represents that you didn't thank me. And you know, without all that fight, she couldn't have gotten there to be able to express it. However, as a viewer, sometimes the film felt a little bit like fight porn. Like, it's just like, okay, so we're just gonna go down again. But at the same time, I will also say that Malcolm was usually the one who made it worse. You know, whenever Marie was trying to explain something, he couldn't ever just stop and listen, hear what she was trying to say, and say, okay, I understand that this is how you feel. No, he had to fight back every time, and then fight like dirtier than her.
Right. And I think that's the kind of key to this. And I think the pacing issue is part of the problem, because it feels like the fight's over and we're going into, I mean, it feels a bit like scenes from a marriage at certain points, and that's probably intentional. But because there's just so much in certain other scenes, we kind of get away from the fight. And I do understand that rhythm that, you know, sometimes you do circle around in a fight. And I think that, I mean, that's kind of what's going on in the film too, is that fights are rarely about the thing that starts the fight, that especially in relationships, and especially in kind of like long-term relationships where there's history you can, or I guess cite precedent on. And yeah, she's upset about the slight, but it's what the slight represents, and it's about the whole history of the relationship, and how it feels like one of them is being elevated on the back of the other, even if that is perhaps not the intent, or perhaps that's the kind of subconscious intent that Malcolm isn't aware of. And he could just listen to her concerns, apologize profusely. But then you do get that scene in the bathtub where she's in the bathtub and he's not, where he just unloads, like, just all this, like, you are not the center of the universe because I took this part from this girlfriend, I took this part from this girlfriend, and he's just emptying all his dirty laundry on her in the tub. And it's just, it feels ugly, it feels brutal, it's just a completely discomfortable scene. But I mean, that's kind of, I think, where everything kind of comes together thematically. And I mean, there is humor in the movie, and there is some, you know, things that, you know, you can sort of sit back and enjoy, whether that's humor, whether that's something that is particularly well put. But that one scene and all of its ugliness, I think that's where, I think that's where this film is made. It's just that one scene, is that all the ugliness that Malcolm displays there.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's hard to decide whether things about this film need to be changed or not, you know, because it is uncomfortable and it's long and it's drawn out sometimes and then whatever, but you know, are we supposed to feel like we're in the room, like we're going through those emotions at the same time? You know, and even right to the end where, I mean, it's probably not really a spoiler, but, you know, the end, we still don't really know what becomes of this couple, which is, you know, true of a fight too, right? It's like, was this the fight that ended it all? Or was this the fight that got us over the problems to start getting better? Or was this just another fight, you know, in a line of fights that happened in a couple over many years? Who knows? You know, you don't know the next morning. But I will say that, you know, despite the pacing and some of the, you know, some of the things that I think this film brings up that you know, maybe are uncomfortable or we have to think about, and that maybe were poorly executed, you know, whether it's the race issue, the actual ugliness of the relationship, those sorts of things. I also just, like, I did really like the film. Like, the black and white, the shots, like, it looked great. The acting, I think, was well done. Zendaya was amazing. John David Washington was, I think he was fine because his character is not really supposed to have depth as far as I'm concerned. So he was fine. And that setting, oh my God, that house, if you're into like
house
architecture,
porn.
Oh yeah, it was great.
Okay. So, well, since I've learned and grown watching Malcolm and Marie, I'll let you have the last word on that. So why don't you tell us where we can find you on the internet if somebody out there wants to give you some more house porn.
Yes. Yes. Send me all of your, you know, videos of interior architecture to Sin48, pretty much everywhere on the internet, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Good Lord. Letterboxd. Not that I'm watching all that many movies lately. Seems like I'm watching a lot more TV, but that's okay.
I was going to add, it is Valentine's Day on Saturday, so house porn seems appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And that is it for this week. We hope you like the show, as always, and if you want to listen to it again, you can find it on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. Download it from the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday at Podbean or through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. And while you're on Spotify, if you're on Spotify, you can get the playlist for most of the music that you hear on the End Credits show. Just search for End Credits on CFRU in Spotify and press play. You can find us on social media on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show or on Twitter at End Credits Radio. I will be back tomorrow at 5 p.m. for news and politics with Scotty Hertz on Open Sources Guelph. In the meantime, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson. You can find my news and politics site at Guelph Politico, or you can read my writing about horror movies at Nightmare on Film Street at nofspodcast.com. And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We will be back next Wednesday at 3 p.m. for another fantastic edition of End Credits, and we will see you then.